Hi friends, I'm alcoholic. My name is James. It's an honor to be at an AA meeting. I am sober today thanks to the grace of God, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the fantastic fellowship that carries the message to an alcoholic like me. One of the first meetings I went to, there was a character who used to call himself a real alcoholic. And I thought he was just trying to make himself look better or more tough or something. And then in the big book somewhere they talk about that. But what about the real alcoholic? They're talking about different types of drinkers, you know. And certainly, if my drinking hadn't progressed to that level, I have all of the alcoholic thinking. So, and the more that I stay around here, I feel like I'm a real alcoholic. I feel more alcoholic than when I first came here. And the date of my last drink is February 6, 1995. I say last, I hope last, my most recent drink. And that to me is a miracle because the 9.5 years or whatever it is the longest time in my life that I've been without a drink or drug. When I was in my mid-20s, I stopped for 5 years once. Very dry and desperate experience. And I wouldn't wish it upon anybody. An alcoholic of my type has about three ways to live that I know. For me, I can drink and drug and be miserable and die, hopefully very quickly. I can somehow, without a program, and at these days it would take restraints of some type and with no program, live without alcohol and drugs, but I'm miserable. I am absolutely miserable. Or the third alternative, which is the wonderful thing, is to use the program of recovery that is suggested to us in the 12 steps and have a chance at a good life. A life that I never imagined. I wanted to escape from my life, or let me put it this way, I wanted my life to fit into my fantasy of what life should be from a very young age. Way before I picked up, I used to love stories. I used to tell myself stories as I was going to sleep. My mom remembers that the way I would fall asleep when I was a little guy, I'd have my thumb in there, I'd be cranking my head back and forth on the pillow, I'd be singing a song to myself, and I would tell myself a story at the same time. This is how wound up I was. And you know, after about 10 minutes of that, I guess, I just conk out. I learned to read mostly because I wanted to escape in books. I loved films. I'm sure I've seen over 2,000 movies in my life, and that's a conservative estimate. So by the time I picked up, and it was kind of late, it was in my last year of high school, I was really ripe for escape time. And at first I loved alcohol and drugs because to me it was a controllable escape hatch, and I'm laughing because I was so out of control. I mean, I never was very graceful. I missed parties. I remember one party I missed because I just drank way too much tequila and then smoked a big bat, and everything inside me came out in copious quantities. It was just gross. And my little brother saw this. You know, let's talk about unmanageable. My little brother, who's just learning to drink cider, you know, is watching his older brother like lose everything and miss the big party, you know, those big exciting parties they wanted to get to, maybe. You know, make some time with a girl that I thought was attractive or something. Well, I certainly missed that. And at that age, already, even before I realized it, drugs and alcohol took priority. You know, I might have told you, oh, no, it's not more important than, let's say, you know, a date or, you know, the possibility is, you know, women were huge. There's another form, it can be another form of escape, the fantasy part of there. But if you watch my behavior, the alcohol and drugs always came first. And I had a lot of girlfriends who didn't like that at all. I don't know, I blame them. But it always came first, and my attitude was like, don't tell me what to do. I'm a free person, I'll do what I want. Same thing happened with my parents. I come from a home in which there wasn't any active alcoholism acted out. A fair bit of insanity, but then again, I don't know, I think another name for neurotic sometimes is human being. In the same way that another name for alcoholic is human being, if we look at some of the character traits of alcoholics is often the human character traits that are just pushed to extremes, you know? And so in my household, some of those character traits that were there were resentment, for instance. We were good at keeping resentments in my family. In fact, some of them I've kept resentments even after the person has died. That's really holding a resentment, you know? Uncle so-and-so is gone,
And you still resent him. He's gone. He's not doing anything to you now. You know, he's dead. He's gone.
So that's a whole hard resentment. And I don't want to be hard on my family, because one of the other characteristics of alcoholism is denial. And when you're in denial, you really don't know what's going on. And I think it's also a characteristic of mental illness a lot of the time. People don't know what's going on. And even more than that, they will protect the thing. We will justify our resentment. It's like, I'm feeling like crap, but I've got a good reason to feel like crap. Let me tell you. Sit down. I'll tell you why I hate so-and-so and my blood boils every time I think of them, which is every 15 minutes. You know, it's like horrible. But we don't know any better. You know. And at the same time, there was a lot of love in my family and a lot of caring. I'm grateful. But alcohol and drugs took me away from them, for sure. I had a big, big falling out, and I don't blame them. I have a son now. He's 3. And, you know, if I ever see him going down the path that I was going down, there's not much you can do. You have a 17-year-old, you know, they just say, bye-bye, see you later, eat my dust, baby, or something stupid, and then go off. And I was squatting for a while in a little apartment on Bulmer, which is a little street behind Claremont. It's adjacent Westmount, but that's about the only thing that's classy about it, because this was a little dump. A place where I paid $10 to a friend of mine for a key that worked in the door. And I stayed there for 3 months until the bank that had repossessed the building started to send somebody around to see who was there and paying rents, you know. This is a sample of one of the places that I lived. And this place, I remember pretty clearly, because back in those days I drank a lot. And I also did a lot of things to help me drink more when I could. I did a lot of acid, because acid was cheap. I did cocaine, but that was more expensive. And in that apartment, some of the doors were missing their middle panel, as if a large living object had been thrown through. And there were tire marks, because bikers used to live. They took their motorcycles up, and there were tire marks on the floor. And, you know, it's not an attractive lifestyle. You know, I never was a very functional alcoholic or drug addict. I mean, by the time I was living there, for instance, I remember being burgled one time, and, you know, feel free, what am I going to do? I'm going to call a cop. He stole my triple beans, you know. Oh, great, my triple beans, which were hot, which I probably traded some dope for, you know. It's crazy. It's a crazy, crazy life. Alcohol was my longest buddy, because I thought I could control booze, plain and simple. I had my most recent drug about... oh geez, 89, what's that, 15 years ago? And that's just a miracle, but I kept drinking after that. And I don't know when I passed the point, but I can tell you, by the time I came to AA, I couldn't tell you when I was going to drink or how much I was going to drink. And I was conscious of trying to control drink, believe me, because I was not a happy camper. And something about going back to that hopelessness over and over, it's like now... I fear relapse for many reasons, partly because I've had a chance to sample my insanity sober, and I would be afraid of what would happen if I was actively drinking, but also because I remember being 19 and feeling like my life is zero. You're 19, healthy at that time, healthy body, you know, nothing wrong, brain still functioning, but I felt that my life was zero. And if I was to drink or drug again, I'm afraid that all that feeling would come back and would be amplified. And I know when I came to you guys, AA was not a place I wanted to come to. I had no family in AA. one of my grandparents had a problem with alcohol, but it was all very hush-hush, and they managed to do something about it, I don't know what, and solve their problem. And I remember seeing a letter from a doctor to one of my parents saying it was great how so-and-so had solved their problem. And I was like, wow, that's great. But it was very hush-hush. On the other side of the other family, one of my grandparents, he was tough. He was a tough Ottawa South guy. And when he was growing up, you went to the dance on Saturday night and you drank and you fought, you know. And then after he married my grandmother, who was Woman Christian Temperance Union, he stopped drinking completely. But his behavior, from what I've heard, you know, went out into other things. Anyways, a human being. But I kind of lost the track of my thought there entirely. Something about Something about alcoholism. No doubt. I hope. I really do. Nobody in my family. I didn't know anything about AA. And in the bars that I was going to, because I was hanging out with the heavier drinkers, we were thinking about trying to do something to help alcoholics on the plateau, alcoholics and drug addicts on the plateau. You know, we're sitting drinking and saying, we've got to start up something. Yeah. Me and a bartender friend of mine, we're going to do this. Can't go to AA because they talk about God. That's all I knew. Can't go to AA because they talk about God. All right. So we're not going there. And I was very lucky because I had a psychologist in my life at the time. I've used the services of many psychological healthcare professionals over the years for various reasons, mostly having to do with either depression or drug and alcohol use or a suicide attempt at one point. But this person I stayed with, and I remember at one time, after about 2.5 years with them, I'm not too quick. After about 2.5 years with them, I decided I better trust this person because I was going through some heavy stuff at the time. And I thought, you know, if I don't try and trust, I think my first wife left, and I realized if I don't trust somebody and start talking about what's going on inside me, I'm not gonna make it. I also started drinking more heavily, so in a way I owe thanks to my first wife too, also that I got to AA, but also to this psychologist because she planted a seed for me. She said, we have too much to talk about, plus you're drinking, because I was going to the sessions half-cocked sometimes, you know, had been drinking a bit. Like I said, I couldn't really control when I was drinking, and sometimes also you drink enough one day, you're still drunk the next day, you know, especially when the day finishes at 5 a.m., 5:30 a.m., you know, it's like I'm not exactly sober at 1 p.m. on the day where I finish drinking at 6 in the morning, you know, it's like... So she said, we have too much to talk about, plus you're drinking. Why don't you go to AA? What's that? And of course, like a good alcoholic, I percolated on that for about 6 months. You know, and I woke up one morning, I should say came to, because that's what I was doing in those days a lot. You know, I come in, I come home, I'm like, I made it home. I can't be that alcoholic. I made it home. I lie in my bed. Get up, lie on the nice wood floor, nice, not moving, cool wood floor, and I pass out. And about 3.5 to 4.5 hours later, boom, the eyes open, you know, the mouth is dry, feeling like crap. And sometimes I would start crying because I knew, like I said, I knew 15 years earlier that it was a hopeless lifestyle. So one of those mornings, I woke up and I'd been thinking about shooting myself back through the back of the head here. Hit the lower brainstem, and supposedly your body functions to stop. Because they don't want to mess it up. I've seen some messed up suicides. Not fun. So I was thinking about that, and a little voice, a voice of grace said to me, well, you can always shoot yourself tomorrow. Why don't you call AA? You know, sounds pretty good. Why don't you call AA? And so I did. I put my resistance to God in my back pocket. Because as I've heard it said, you can't save your ass and your face at the same time. And I called AA. And there was somebody there. You know. And Grant was talking about getting active and how it's helped him in sobriety. Every single person that has been there over the years for me, from that first guy, Fernand, who answered the phone, has helped me to stay sober. You know, I have a debt of gratitude which I cannot even measure. You know, this guy came, he was doing phone chips. I didn't know what a phone chip was, but this guy was doing a phone chip when I called. And I didn't even know that if you flip the meeting list over, there are English meetings. So he spoke to me in French, I spoke to him in French. What's, you know, what do you want to do, blah, 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 blah. He sent me to a meeting, and people greeted me there, and they welcomed me into AA right away. And here's another grace. I had a tendency to arrive late for things, or very, very close. And that night was no exception. Only this meeting that I was sent to was in a CLSC in the basement. And at 8 o'clock, when the meeting starts, they lock the door because they can't greet at the same time. Well, I arrived at, like, I think, 7:59:45 kind of thing. I just made it in, you know. And I went downstairs, and it was a smoking meeting. They were all smoking pretty... They weren't all smoking, but the non-smoking meetings were just starting. And I was like, oh, phew. You know, I pulled out my drum and, you know, rolled up a stinker. And this guy came over to me and he said, are you new? And I'm like, I don't know, how can you tell, you know, this is on my forehead. And he said, oh, we'll talk after, because the meeting was just about to start, right? So I heard a young lady share, she drank wine alone in her apartment. I did none of those things. I mean, I drank alone in my apartment, but I certainly didn't drink wine. And I used to like to go out and hit the places on Saint Laurent or anywhere else. In fact, in my last couple of years of drinking, I was living in an area where there were lots of bars, and I was happy because I knew I had started driving in blackouts, and it's not a good thing at all. It's not nice to have to, well, first of all, to come to in your car and not know where you are, to come to in your car and not know how you got to where you got to, or to wake up and go, I don't know where my car is, or to wake up and go, fuck, and have to go back, you have to edit that, have to go back and like do a walk around, you know, walk around the car and check it out. It's very creepy. And so even, it's funny, we have grace working even inside us, even when we don't know what that is. So I was living in an area where I did a lot of drinking there. What was the point of saying that? I had no idea. Anyways, how did I get to that? I don't know, I'm sure there was a threat, but it doesn't really matter. I was welcomed, and this fellow came up to me. Oh yeah, I used to go out a lot, that's right. Because the woman I heard share, the point I was trying to make was that she drank wine alone, and she was a lot younger than me. She was 13 years younger than me. But there was a feeling of desperation that I related to. You know, and she was attractive. And then her boyfriend was there, but it doesn't matter. You still have the hormones. But I could relate to the feelings. And they told me about another meeting. And this guy who came up to me before the meeting said, what are you doing after the meeting? And I'm not like, you know, oh, no, let me check my schedule, you know, go home, try not to think of suicide, you know. Yeah, I have big plans for my evening. But I didn't have any plans. We went over to his place. I remember we had soup and toast and smoked cigarettes and talk. And he gave me literature. He gave me, I still have like stools and bottles, some old Hazelden stuff, you know. It's pretty wild. He gave me all this literature. He was really giving me a really nice welcome, a real nice 12th step. I didn't even know what that was. And he said to me, I have to speak tomorrow at a meeting, and I don't know many people, and it would be nice to see a familiar face. Would you come and support me? Well, the next day, the meeting was at, it was called Rachel Drolet, was at the corner of Duluth and Saint-Denis, and I think it's a Franciscan monastery there that used to, not monastery or residence, and they have a meeting room in the basement, and they used to have meetings, lunchtime meeting in French there. And I went in, there were about 150 people there, he knew about 90 of them, okay, but he had got me to another meeting, you know, and that's the beauty of it. It's so important. The contact face to face with other alcoholics is absolutely vital. I feel like stressing it all the more because there might be somebody listening to this sometime on their computer, and it's great, get a message, but get to meet other people like yourself. Because I'll tell you something, I was much too smart to see how stupid I've been all my life, and I needed people like you to tell me, okay James, take it easy, you need to take a deep breath, the fire will burn down a little bit, okay, the hamster will stop running at 120 kilometers an hour in your head. Take a deep breath, relax, keep coming back. Read this, but don't worry about it too much. Easy does it. I needed that. I needed people who had lived the experience before me and who welcomed me. This was incredible. Because all my life I'd been learning things real fast. I needed a quick study artist. I was going to be a great success in 6 weeks. And then I'd crash and burn. You know, or somebody would say, I don't like the color of your tie. And I'd get all bent out of shape. And, you know, bye-bye. But AA, you guys, it's like your requirements were things I could fulfill. My first sponsor said to me, go to a meeting every day. Pretty simple. This is your job for now. Go to a meeting every day. Because I came in, I was suicidal, I'd been drinking a lot. I couldn't function in a normal world. I needed to start to experience sobriety. I didn't even know what functioning in a normal world was. I always thought it was all about impressing people and making you think I was doing a good job and giving me lots of money fast and then getting the hell out while I could. You know? So the contact is absolutely vital. Because what I said before, it sounds like a spiel, but without the fellowship to carry the message, I would miss it. I'm moving too fast. I'm driving at fucking 160 kilometers an hour. I'm not seeing the flowers. It's just blur, right? Until kaboom or whatever. And I need, when I see you guys, there's a part of me that won't let the bullshit fly. A part of me deep inside that goes, I like that. I like what I see. And my first home groups are like that. We're made of people like that. And I found in every room, no matter what I even thought, some meetings I'd be like, oh, this meeting they have to wear ties or whatever, something. I don't like that. But even in those meetings, there would always be one or two people that touched me because they were interested in sobriety. They were interested in a good life. And that's what I find that is precious here. And it's this interest in sobriety and a good life and the interest in sharing it. It's like saying, this is what I've got. Here, I'll help you. Help yourself to it because it's going to help me too. You know, that just blows me away. And the spirit is, it's kind of indomitable. In the sense like, well, Sean asked me to speak about a week ago. I'm in divorce proceedings with my second wife, who has chosen to take the legal Klingon battleship fleet route of divorce. And it's not pleasant. I get letters from the Department of Youth Protection. I get the psychologist suggesting that there are concerns about maybe sexual misconduct, all kinds of crap. Like, I mean, everything. The mud is out and it's flying, right? So I'm thinking, what the heck do I have to offer you guys about sobriety? You know, how to fail in two marriages, you know, come and see me. Hey, I'll tell you, turn your will and your life over because you can't pick them. You know, holy jeez. Yes, surrender your relationships. But, you know, I've been helped so much in AA that I couldn't say no. I couldn't say no unless I really had a legitimate reason, like we're talking serious, you know. My mom's going to have surgery or something. And despite myself, I have something to offer because I haven't taken a drink or a drug. And not only that, I don't have, since the divorce proceedings started with the bailiff arriving and all kinds of nice correspondence, they call them affidavits, they're lovely signatures and everything is stamps, and you got 5 days to get yourself a lawyer and get your ass in the court and protect yourself. Ever since that started, I haven't done anything that I'm ashamed of. I've thought of a few things. In fact, sometimes I thought of things that would make her accusations correct. You know, it's funny, eh? Ah! Okay. Oh, wow, look, he's angry. Look, he acted out. But I haven't done anything. Grace has worked in my life, is working, and I pray, I'm not out of the force, but I pray to keep going this way, going to meetings, sharing with members, getting out of myself. And lo and behold, time elapses, and the more time that goes by, the more I heard, and look, I mean, last week in a meeting, I heard a guy say, the best revenge is to live a good life. Wow, that's exactly what I need. Just live a good life. It looks good to the judges, looks good to the lawyers, looks good to the psychologists, and best of all, that's the most important thing, it feels good in here. Because just like going to pick up and use now, and behave in some ways that I know can get me fired up and stirred, the same thing, retaliation, resentment. It's not for nothing that they say that resentment's the number one offender in this book. It's important to pay attention to that. Because I know I get heated up and I start justifying myself and I start thinking, boy, it would feel good if I did this. I want to do that. Blah, 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 blah. And I start bubbling a little bit inside and getting twisty and stuff. And for me, that's where the think, think, think slogan comes in. Most of the time, my thinking is pretty useless. But if I play through that scenario, right through to the end, just like picking up the drink or the drug, how am I going to feel afterwards? Not only that, but if I really care about my son, if it's not just BS, right, what's the best thing for him? To cause havoc in his mom's life? No, absolutely not. Absolutely not. And I've gotten all of this thanks to AA. 100%. Because there's a time where I don't think I would have realized I have a choice in how I can behave. There's a time in my life where I think I would have just justified some kind of retaliation, or at least we're going to have a good talk. You know? You want to talk to me through your lawyer all the time? Well, hell, I'm going to drop in like Spider-Man. We're going to have a little chat. You know? Only that doesn't look so good. Next thing you know, restraining order. Oh, this is lovely. You know? And I don't want to do that. Because then what I'm doing is I'm saying she's right, too. Do I want to do that? So the power of recovery is amazing. And believe me, if you lived inside my head, you'd go, wow, it works. You know? Because I can be completely nuts. Completely nuts. And I start praying. I start thinking about the four-step prayer in here. You know, this is a sick person. How can I be helpful? God, save me from being angry. You know? That's big. That's huge. And also they talk about it, and I didn't really see it before, but when they're talking about doing the inventory, they talk about starting to see other people like ourselves as suffering also. People that we felt hurt by. And that's really important, because if they're just like me, then I've got to try to offer them the same opportunity for mercy and redemption and salvation that I'd like. Because I've screwed up big time in my life. And I've kind of hoped and counted on, in fact, the universe, God, and the rest of you guys at some point saying, you know, Jamie boy, it's okay. You're forgiven. You're trying hard now, it's all right. But I need to be able to extend that on to other people too. Otherwise, I really realize that now too. This experience is really bringing this home for me, that I will not grow spiritually beyond a certain point as long as I hold resentment. As long as I'm holding hateful thoughts, it just doesn't happen at all. And I got to let go of it. And not only that, I'm not capable of my own. No matter how clever I may think I am, or no matter how humble I may think I am, or whatever, I'm not capable by myself of going through that spiritual transformation. So I have to use and be open to what's there. God, power greater than myself, whatever you want to call it, but also circumstances. Because I was saying to somebody earlier, I hope it doesn't take too long before I can actually say to Connie, that's the name of my son's mom and my second wife, I hope it's not too long before I can say to her, thank you, you're helping me. You helped me to grow by doing something that pushed me to an edge where I had to choose either spiritual growth or going backwards into hell, into a really bad place. You know? And that's something. Because I wouldn't have done it for myself. I still like pleasure and I hate pain. You know? So I wouldn't do it for myself. But if somebody else does it for me, if I can capitalize on it, then something else I hear in the room can work possibly. And that is, misfortune, when taken nobly, becomes good fortune. I want it happen fast. I don't have all this endurance, but part of it is it's in God's time. That's part of it too. I have to just accept there's some pain I'm living through now. It's mostly around my son, because the marriage was difficult for a long time. I don't think... anyways, I won't get into the details with it, but it's not like my heart is broken. But it's hard to see my son in short supervised visits. I feel like I'm being condemned already sometimes, and to miss so much of his life in the last 3 months. However, people have gone through all kinds of things in their lives, and they don't have to drink because of it, and they don't have to drug. And not only that, usually they come through and they seem to have a shine. I don't know how many of you know Billy S. on the West Island. There's a good example. Oh my God. And I remember seeing another old timer speak out at Serendipity, and it reminded me of that, because he had undergone cancer operations, numerous. And what he was saying is, if you're in a happy, healthy place in sobriety right now, he said, fantastic, enjoy it, but don't stop going to the meetings. Keep going and build. Because you may come to a time where you need that, and you can't get to the meeting because of your condition or your loved one's condition. And I found that to be very, very true. There is a time where we are alone with our Creator, and that's it. You know? Or in my case, there's the three of us. Me, my insanity, and God. But I have to have, if I don't have enough of a connection, my insanity takes over and the beast has grabbed me and I'm screwed. And what to me the steps are all about is establishing that connection and going, and it's not only establishing the connection, but establishing the recognition of the need. You know, I have to recognize that I need this, and that I need it. Not just, oh, I did my little step intensive for 17 weeks 3 years ago, you know. Great. You know, step intensives are wonderful. But if I don't carry this stuff with me today, I'm still screwed, because I need it as much as I did when I walked in the doors. I need it like a guy who falls off a ship in the North Atlantic, is in frozen water, and they throw him, life preserver or whatever they call it. He doesn't think about, will I grab it? It's like, you grab the sucker, pull me up, because the water's cold. And I have to, it sounds extreme, but my thinking, and this is alcoholic thinking, is that I can afford to play around. I can afford to skip down the garden path a little bit, or do some kind of BS inside my head, or to contemplate some kind of justified revenge. That's a classic one these days. And it's not true. It's not true. I cannot afford to contemplate these things. They make me sick. And there is no separation. We live in a world where everybody's trying to protect themselves from what could happen, or from that bad person, or with insurance, with armies, with shock and awe, whatever. And we're just brothers and sisters living on the same planet. There is no separation. We're going to discover that at some point. We're doing it to ourselves. Anything that Connie does to me, she's doing to herself. And anything I do to her, I'm doing to myself. So the best thing I can do is to say, I bless you, and I wish you every happiness. Now, I kind of strain a lot of things on it, you know, for maybe for the program purists, they don't like that. That's too bad. But I'm up here, I'm talking in tough luck. But I do feel that it is pertinent that the application of the program and how God is working in my life through a recognition of willingness or recognition of need on my part, and that I have to be willing. And for me, I think that's a testimony that this stuff works. And if it works for me, as I said, with the fireworks that I get going on, I think it can work for you too, to help you not only to not drink and drug, but to have a life where you're not going to want to drink and drug. Because that's why I stopped the first time I was 19, but I went back to it because I didn't know how to live. And you take me away from my medicine for a while, and I get pretty desperate. You know, and then I want to pick up again. And then all of a sudden, all the crap I got into is kind of, oh, it's not so bad. Or even worse, I don't care. I'm hurting and I'm going to hurt myself some more the way I know how. Like, let's go. Great, you know. And the AA program offers me a chance to live a life where I don't want to do that. I don't want to lose the opportunity. I think the last thing I want to say, sometimes you might hear a lot of expressions. Anyway, somebody I know says, if it isn't in here, you know, don't pay much mind to it. But sometimes it's good for thought. And one of them is that my best day drinking is not as good as my worst day sober. Now, I used to think, that's just nuts. I had some good parties when, you know, early on, this and that, and I've had some tough times in sobriety. But what that means to me today is that because of sobriety, I have the opportunity to look at life in an entirely different way. And just that in itself is worth whatever I'm going through, and better than the high-flying, I'm on cloud nine, but watch me tomorrow, I'm going to be in the Marianas Trench experiences that I used to have when I was using it. So please go to lots of meetings. If you don't know what this is, my God, come and get one, because they're really important. I'm holding a meeting list. Get out if you can. If you're online, type away if you can't get out. But please get in touch with other alcoholics. It will enrich your life. It has enriched mine. And I wish you many days of contented sobriety. Thank you. Thank you.